It's WrestlePod, the Troopany Show, with your host, James Troopany.
Hello and welcome to the Troopany Show. My name is James Troopany and this is my show. And my guest today is Mr. Marcus Green of Baton Rouge, Louisiana. How are you, sir?
I'm good. It's good to be back on the show with you, talking to some Japan Pro, New Japan Pro Wrestling.
Yeah, today we're talking about the history of Japanese wrestling, and this will be part of a long, long series as we try and cover the entire history of Japanese pro wrestling ever. From the very beginning. But right now, we will take a word from our sponsors.
WrestlePlus.com is the brand new home of incredible online wrestling content, featuring uncensored shoot interview classics, full series of WrestleTalk TV and British Wrestling Weekly, exclusive documentaries, British wrestling's biggest names before they were stars, an incredible podcast collection, up to 90% off merchandise offers, and the brand new Power Slammed e-magazine forwarded by Finn Martin himself. WrestlePlus has thousands of hours of content with new and exclusive releases added regularly. You can join today for the stupidly low price of just £4.99 a month. Wrestle Plus, because this is wrestling.
Welcome back. Yeah, today we're talking about the history of Japanese wrestling, and there's reasons why I wanted to do this. We got a lot of feedback over our New Japan G1 Climax coverage, and a few people have said that how informative our podcasts are, and I kind of thought it'd be nice to go in depth on one particular subject, and then I figured out, well, how about we did the entire thing? Everything in Japanese wrestling history. So we're going to look at Joshi, we're going to look at the origins of Japanese wrestling, and we're going to look at everything that's happened up until the present day to give you an idea of how Japanese wrestling works, because there's a lot of conventions in Japanese wrestling. There's a lot of stuff that's very, very traditional within Japanese wrestling, and it all came from certain places. So I wanted to talk about that. Marcus has agreed to do this first episode with me, and you've been doing some research this week. I hope you've found it interesting.
Yeah, really interesting, particularly just, overall how wrestling first, kind of emanated in Japan, because it wasn't always a thing, and, wrestling in particular that we're going to get into, and, his influence over the sport and how it's kind of evolved into the style we're talking about today. It's really, obviously it had a great starting point, but it's, interesting seeing all the hands that kind of, picked up the proverbial ball and, run with it.
Yeah, it's been interesting because I see Japanese wrestling as kind of like, how can I put it? It's kind of the opposite of American wrestling, because obviously in American wrestling, you have all these little pockets of companies that started all over the country that convalesced into the NWA, and then offices got bigger in the NWA until one broke away, which was the WWF. And then it became a national promotion and they all kind of like collapsed behind this one big company. Whereas in Japan, you start with one big company until you get to the point today where if you consider a major promotion as a promotion that can fill a 5,000 seater building, well, you've got maybe 7 or 8 companies that could do that. You know, this is the fascinating part for me because it's the nature of the way of pro wrestling has worked in Japan. I think it's a fascinating story. So hopefully you'll find it interesting and you'll find little threads that you can pull out from modern day wrestling. So we'll start at the beginning. Okay. And we're talking about Japan in just after the Second World War. Now we talk in Europe a lot about how Germany won the peace in the rebuilding of Japan the rebuilding of Germany through the Marshall Plan. And much the same thing happened in Japan. You know, they became a heavily industrialized nation. But there was certain issues with the national psyche of Japan. And, this was a country that was in defeat. And that's important to remember from a practical point of view. Firstly, there was a heavy occupation of United States troops in Japan for a very long period of time after the Second World War. And you know anything about history, you have to keep young men who have lots of free time on their hands and lots of cash fairly occupied to keep them fit and their mind on the job. And that a lot of that fell down to the organization called the USO. Marcus, could you explain what the USO is and what it does?
Yeah, basically, the USO is a non-profit organization, that basically serves to, you know, keeping, you know, America's military service, you know, connected and strong, and, you know, keeping them connected to their families, home, and countries throughout, you know, like you said, their service, you know, through entertainment and various forms of that. Like you said, keeping them kind of on track, you know, during World War II, the USO became a lot of GIs home away from home, and really became a tradition entertaining the troops. So, yeah, you know, a lot of Americans have, you know, volunteered and you know, making this a consolidated effort just because, like you said, of everything that was going on. And especially during that time, it really was a sense of grounding for them to really, you know, take their mind off what they were doing, but at the same time, allowing them to, you know, keep focused.
Yeah. And, you know, you still had the draft in the U.S. Army, so you had a lot of these people were taken from Civvy Street and placed on the other side of the world and told to look after Japan. And anything that could bring them back to home for a while would be good for them. So the USO did organize a lot of entertainment that was more traditional in the sense of vaudeville and comedy and music. But one of the things they found was a hit was obviously because the draft took a percentage of the population, there was always a couple of pro wrestlers in several units in Japan. They started to put on shows for their own entertainment, for the own entertainment of their colleagues. And as they've actually found to be quite popular amongst American soldiers, seamen, and airmen, so they started bringing in people from North America. And very famously, Mildred Burke was one of the people that was brought in from North America for an American show. But these shows weren't just open to American soldiers, they were open to the Japanese public as well. And that's what started the burgeoning interest in pro wrestling in the late 1940s. I find that bit really interesting because it shows how pro wrestling spread, because there was wrestling in Japan before, but it wasn't, you know, as a dominant trope within Japanese entertainment. There was lots of sports in Japan. Baseball was very big, and so was sumo. You know, these sports that we traditionally associate with Japan, they were massive. But yeah, pro wrestling started to grow in that time period.
Yeah, I think we can perhaps even trace it, you know, back before that time. I'm thinking what it was 1887 that a guy by the name of Hamada attempted to bring pro wrestling to Japan. I think along with like 20 American wrestlers, and like you said, it was you know, got off to a decent start, but you know, sadly it really didn't go too far. Like you said, you know, pre-World War II, it was, you know, it just didn't really have a spark. But I think everything that had transpired, you know, throughout that part of history and afterwards, it really created a necessity for that niche that it eventually carved out.
Yeah, so there was the American style of wrestling gave Japan, you know, the starting point. Okay, but it didn't really kick off until the early 1950s, and that was down to really one man, which was Riki Dozan, who was born Matsuhiro Momota in actually North Korea, though he kept that very quiet for a very long period of time, it felt not till after his death, and he was considered a Japanese hero. Before he was a pro wrestler, he was a sumo, and he was a big, strong, young guy, but he was never quite getting there. He was never quite the favorite of the bosses in sumo. He was never quite the guy to get to Yokozuna standard. And he realized he wasn't going to be the guy to get to Yokozuna standard. So he quit sumo. And he started in pro wrestling, and he was encouraged by a guy called Harold Sakata, who you may know, older listeners to the Troopany Show, as Oddjob from the Bond films in the 1960s. And Sakata trained Riki Dozan in pro wrestling in Japan. And then Riki Dozan, realizing he needed more depth, went on a learning tour and a learning excursion to North America and wrestled all over the United States of America in a two-year period, which is, funnily enough, how the majority of Japanese wrestlers today work. You know, they do their initial training within the dojo, and then they go off to North America or Europe or Australia, and they do what are called seasoning tours. And then they come back and are reintroduced to the audience. So he was the first, but even when he was starting his training, he was laying the foundation of how pro wrestling in Japan was going to work.
Yeah, so, like I said, it kind of sparked something immensely popular because, like I said, during that time, he really, you know, got popular because, you know, he the guy, like you said, he eventually became a hero, but he'd be the guy to kind of stand up to the Americans.
Yeah.
And when he kind of came over here, he'd be seen as the villain and, you know, obviously a hero over there, which is the inverse of what we get today where, you know, the gaijin will go to Japan and kind of be seen as the villain. And, you know, vice versa. So, you know, the more things change, you know, the more it stays the same.
It's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah.
When he got back to Japan, he formed the Japan Pro Wrestling Alliance in 1953. And he did it with the help of the Yakuza, who were, you know, the organized crime of Japan, which is unfortunately another tradition that he started in pro wrestling. But he was a massively popular star. He traded on his sumo alliances and his sumo popularity. And as Marcus said, he booked a lot of American wrestlers to come in to really play the Japanese hero. And that's how he sold it to his business partners. This wasn't about wrestling. It wasn't about sport. It was about giving a national identity to the Japanese people that had been missing it since the beginning of the Second World War, or since the end of the Second World War. You know, this was a nice form of soft nationalism and escapism that the Japanese people could indulge in without it really meaning anything. And I think that's really, really important. You know, the Gaijin element of pro wrestling in Japan was really founded in these years. And some of the big matches that he had in Japan in that particular era, certainly the early 1950s, were with the Sharp brothers. Now, again, older fans might remember perennial WWE loser Iron Mike Sharp, but his father and his uncle, the Sharp brothers, I think that was Ben and Mike Sr., they were massive stars in Japan. And Riki Dozan and Masahiko Kimura, who were the two biggest stars in Japan, faced them in tag matches all over the country. And if you look at some of those matches, the action is dated, as you would imagine. It's from the 1950s, but it is such a visceral kind of reaction from the crowd. When we were told, you know, that pro wrestling fans in Japan were always very quiet, but they're certainly not in those matches.
No, it wasn't. And like you said, it's kind of early stages of what we're going to, you know, get into later about the overall Japanese style. But it, at the same time, it still, you know, has a, you know, very grainy kind of visceral feel to it.
Yeah.
Until we get to the matches, even though it was obviously paced, it still had that very, you know, legitness to it even then.
Yeah, definitely. You know, it's very hard-hitting. It's very much in kind of like a more standard North American-style match. In fact, I would go hazard to say anyone who's seen the Big Daddy matches of the 1980s, it's very similar to that. Kimura, who's the lesser star, starts off with the Sharp brothers, gets beaten pillar to post in the first fall. And then in the second fall, Riki Dozan makes the big comeback for his team and takes a fall against one of the Sharp brothers. I can't remember which one. Mike Sharp. He takes the fall against Mike Sharp, and they go into the final four as final fall all even. And then, I think Riki Dozan and Kimura win. But it didn't really matter, even if they drew, you know, that would protect the Sharps' draw and they could do it all over again. And, you know, you had an audience that was willing to accept finishes that weren't clean cut, so long as the moral story had been told there.
Yeah, and you know, just talking about Ricky again, like you said, he was, you know, basically considered a Japanese hero. And an argument can be made that he kind of did, you know, for the sport, kind of like what Hulk Hogan did over here.
Yeah.
And I think what, you know, even Brett did for Canada. So, you know, like you said, you know, when it, in terms of America and in Japan, is very different. Whereas, you know, it started as one thing over here and branched out into a lot of different things. And just talking about Ricky himself, you can very much see that in the wrestlers that basically were influenced by him when his, essentially, you know, his time was cut short. So.
Yeah, definitely. The next real big series for the JWA and for Riki Dozan himself was actually Masahiko Kimura. Kimura was another wrestler who had trained in mixed martial arts. He was a judo player as we call him now, rather, or a judoka, I suppose we'd actually probably call him to be more correct. And he started his own wrestling promotion and was doing quite well. But they wanted to form a Japanese wrestling championship, and as they were the two biggest draws, it seemed to be the most obvious thing to do in wrestling. Now, I've actually seen these championship matches, and it turns into a bit of a shoot because Riki Dozan actually goes into business for himself and chops Kimura into the throat, which is obviously a serious no-no in pro wrestling, but he managed to get away with it, and Kimura actually slumps to the floor and is defeated by Riki Dozan, who lays some heavy-duty boots into him.
To the head, I think.
Yeah.
I was just kind of looking at that. Looking at it today, like the closest thing that kind of reminded me of, I guess in more recent memory, was kind of the whole Del Rio and Cara debacle.
Yeah.
That happened and things of that nature, but, you know, like you said back then, even... during that time, that was just like a big no-no, and it kind of felt like I said, those matches were very much precursors to a more streamlined version of what we get today of the Japanese wrestling style. But even then, when it started happening, it was very awkward. So you can immediately tell like there was something wrong, because like you said, he slumped down and hit the floor, and Dozan was like, "Come on, come on!" And the ref was like, "Whoa, what's going on?" So.
Yeah, he's just like amazing this big throat chop. And Kimura just falls to the floor like a sack of spuds. and then Riki Dozan starts laying these boots in really thick and heavily. And then, of course, ends up winning the Japanese championship, which is good for him, but not necessarily good for co-promotion. And after that, Kimura certainly didn't trust Riki Dozan to get in the ring with him again, even though, you know, Kimura could handle himself. Inventor of the Kimura lock, a popularizer of the Kimura lock, what tends to be was called the double wrist lock back in the day, a genuine shoot fighter as well. You know, he was a genuinely hard man, and the fact that Riki Dozan caught him unawares is probably, you know, a bit of a legacy to the Riki Dozan story that, you know, to give it fair, we have to be fair to give it both sides, was Kimura cheated? Well, probably, because the agreement, apparently, according to Kimura, the agreement was they decided over rock, paper, scissors to do the best of three falls, but best of three matches in a best of three falls, as all JWA main events then were. The best of three falls. So yeah, it was interesting to watch that tape. You can find it on YouTube because, you know, it's long since passed its copyright issues. So because it's that old now. So yeah, you should go have a look at that. It's interesting. You know, you see shoot videos from down the years, and this was probably one of the earliest examples of like someone going into business for themselves and shooting for themselves.
Well, it goes back to the foundation of, you know, when you get in those matches, it is a two-way dance, if you will, and there is a certain level of trust that goes into that. And, you know, naturally, like you said, you know, he could obviously handle himself in that situation against Dozan, but you know, when you go into those matches, there's a certain a kinship and agreement of what's to be done and what have you. And of course, you know, in Japan, those things are kind of more loosely, more given more space to breathe because, like you said, it's more of a combat sport. But at the same time, like I said, there's a certain level of trust. And like you said, Dozan kind of went to business for himself. And, you know, no matter what, even in pro wrestling today, that's seen as a negative issue. So,
yeah. Well, whilst the Kimura feud was going on as well, Riki Dozan did have some trips to the United States to kind of build his legacy. And in 1953, he wrestled Luthez for the first time in Mid-Pacific at the Civic Auditorium in Honolulu, Hawaii. Obviously not a big trip from Japan, but certainly would have been a massive draw for Peter Maivia's organization. I'm pretty sure it was Peter Maivia who was booking back then. But yeah, he wrestles Luthez, goes to a 40, he gets beat, which obviously is no problem for him because no one in Japan would see it, which is the important thing. And Luthez takes him to 43 minutes, lasting 43 minutes with the world's heavyweight champion. And Luthez, you know, was a god of pro wrestling and certainly somebody he wasn't going to take advantage of in any way, shape, or form.
Yeah.
It did his career no end of good because you look fast forward a couple of years and all of a sudden Luthez wants to go to Japan. And in 1957, they wrestled to a time limit draw in Kurikan Stadium, which was the baseball stadium where Tokyo Dome currently sits. And it was a 30,000-seater outdoor stadium and they wrestled to a 61-minute draw, which was the biggest rated TV show in wrestling of all time. something like 70 million people saw that match in Japan. And this is really where pro wrestling starts to get big.
Like a 60-minute draws, like it's, you sit there all that time, you get all that excitement in this whole grand thing, and then it's kind of disappointing when you get that draw.
Yeah.
Obviously. Really disappointing, because a lot of times, I think we'll get off into this later when we talk about the overall style itself. But I think in some parts, you know, you kind of had to have a decisive victory in terms of, you know, like we said, it's a combat sport. So, you know, knock out a tap out and not necessarily pin up, you know, pin. So, you know, to have those two top level talents and, you know, to come to a draw, like I said, is hugely disappointing. But at the same time, you know, for Thayer's basically, did the honors, if you will, for Dozan. But, you know, like you said, it was at the expense of his own reputation. But I think it really did a lot of good in terms of, you know, building that respect. And I don't think it's something that, was lost on Dozan, what happened. And, you know, obviously he went on in his career to, I think, kind of, carry some of that with him in terms of growing the sport.
Just to give you an idea, in the space of just of what that particular tour was like for JWA, between the 7th of October 1957 and the 21st of October 1957, so that's 14 days, they wrestled each other 7 times in 14 days with 5-hour long time limit draws, which is just insane.
Yeah, it really is.
Luthes did win the series over that tour because he had two 1 pinfall victories in Hiroshima and Kobe. But, you know, this was just what wrestling was like at the time. But again, it set the precedent for pro wrestling in Japan. The Japanese companies didn't do continuous touring like the WWE does today. They did 2 or 3 weeks on the road. They put big matches in the right places. And you know, that was how it all worked out. Thayer obviously was happy to wrestle Riki Dozan because he was making good money, because these are all kind of like big stadium places. The Kobe Municipal Oji Gymnasium in Kobe, the Hiroshima Civic Ballpark, another ballpark, you know, another 20,000-seater. The Fukuoka Sports Center in Fukuoka, another 20,000-seater. You know, they were making big money at the time for pro wrestling as a live event draw. And, you know, Thayer was very happy to build a new market for the NWA and build a new market for pro wrestling.
Yeah, this wasn't bingo halls by any means, by any stretch of imagination. And for them to, you know, go out there, you know, all those nights and you know, put on those length of matches and still create an atmosphere that would allow people to want to see those matches, even with the draws, it really speaks to the level of talent and overall aura that these guys had during that time.
Yeah, definitely. And certainly Luthes put even more faith into Riki Dozan when in 1958, Riki Dozan returned the favor and turned to the United States of America and wrestled at the Olympic Auditorium in Los Angeles in the LaBelle's territory over there in LA. And he defeated Luthes for the NWA International Heavyweight Championship. Now, the International Heavyweight Championship was an interesting title belt. As far as I can remember, as far as the lineage is concerned, if this makes any sense. Basically, Lou used to like to go skiing, and the best skiing in the world to go on holiday is in Europe. But obviously, the NWA weren't that keen on him going to Europe because it wasn't as big a money draw for the American organizations, and it wasn't a big money draw for the Japanese organizations because the European scene wasn't as hot as North America or Japan. So what Lou would agree to do is drop the NWA Heavyweight Championship, and then he'd go to Japan as the go to Europe as the NWA International Heavyweight Champion, wrestle all over Europe, get a skiing holiday in, go back to North America, pick up where he left off. That was generally what happened in this particular period. So the NWA International Heavyweight Championship didn't have a lot of lineage, didn't really mean a lot, but Luthes was the champion, so therefore it meant a lot more than it should have done. and Riki Dozan defeats Luthes. Now, that championship then becomes the basis of the JWA. It becomes the top drawing championship in the JWA, the most important championship. And of course, Riki Dozan is the ace of the company and establishes the role of ace, which is something that's still very important in Japanese wrestling today.
Yeah, I mean, just talking about that, I mean, that's very interesting. Like you said, it's very peculiar Especially looking at that in today's time, it'll be almost unheard of. Kind of feel like to see something like that today, especially because it just at times just so many restrictions. But at the same time, again, that speaks to you know, Luthez's presentation and his presence in the industry and his importance, because like at that time he made the title.
Yeah.
And a lot of times in today's climate, sometimes a lot of guys try to get the title, you know, and try to do the reverse of that, where they want to make the title, but at the same time, obviously certain credibility is lost, and that doesn't always work out. But you know, like you said, that will become huge for the JWA, and obviously even, you know, with, like you said, that the shot he took with his reputation, Thez is his importance in the industry with German suplexes and everything he kind of innovated, it just, you know, those things aren't forgotten. And like I said, I think his influence over that time, especially over with Mr. Dozan, like you said, set the foundation for things as Dozan would become the ace of his promotion, much like we would see with guys later on, like the great Muta with his. So.
Yeah, definitely. And then Ricky Dozan becomes a draw in America again as well. You know, he's known outside of Japan. He goes back to the Olympic Auditorium and defeats classy Freddie Blassie for the WWA World Heavyweight Championship, a championship that was pretty much solely defended in LA and California, because by then the California office had kind of drifted away from the NWA. The match with Freddie Blassie is actually hilarious. It's really good for its time period, because Freddie Blassie is like the ultimate heel and he just kicks and bites and things his way through the championship. But it's a really interesting finish to the match. As always in a championship match at the time, it was best of three falls. But the first fall is won by Ricky Dozan when Freddie Blassie flees the ring from Ricky Dozan's chop attack, and the referee says that's a fall because Freddie Blassie is no longer defending himself, and referee's decision says that's a fall. And I thought, that is one of the most creative things I've ever seen in a pro wrestling ring. Run away, you lose the fall. That's genius.
And that would have been inside a riot over here now, I think.
Yeah.
In American wrestling, just because it's like, what? Like, although it makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
You know, just because of how it's been, like, again, that goes to you know, the seriousness and the way it was portrayed and credit, to how, you know, still portrayed in Japan. Like, it very much seriously, like you said, it makes perfect sense. He can no longer defend himself. And that, by far, that is him running is technically, you know, almost like a little forfeit.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's a fall. But over here, that would be seen as completely nonsensical.
Well, no, this was in California. This was in L.A., but it was 1962.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's that is interesting.
It is, isn't it? Because it is just like, I suppose it's no different to Bayley's unable to defend herself against Asuka at NXT Dallas.
Yeah.
In one sense. But even then, there were people who were like, what's happened?
Yeah.
You know, and it's like this, and it was really strange, this championship match. It was also a curfew. It was TV time remaining, which is unusual for a championship match at the time. So the match went to the time limit, and there was only one fall. So Ricky Dozan wins the championship without pinning or submitting Freddie Blassie.
Wow.
That was very interesting. And it just seemed like, but it did make perfect sense. You're right. It was very kind of like watching the match, and I'm a little, obviously I'm 50 years, 60 years removed from it, but it's like, this is interesting. It was very basic for what it was for two great wrestlers, and it goes to show that draws don't have to be great wrestlers. Freddie Blassie was not a mat technician by any stretch of the imagination, but it was interesting to watch, and Ricky Dozan's ability to transcend an audience. He was wildly popular in that arena. You know, and he'd spent a few matches there, and obviously some of his time in America. But moving on, because he dropped the championship about 3 months later, back to Freddie Blassie. And he gets back to Japan, and through the rest of 62 and 63, he works a lot of tag matches, as is the way, and the All-Asian Tag Team title, a title that still exists to this day, as does the International Heavyweight Championship, were really a lot of his concentration. He teams with Tony Bori against Buddy Austin and Mike Sharp to take the championships, drops it back to the same team, and then they take it off Fred Atkins and Killer Kowalski in Sapporo. And that's pretty much where the Ricky Dozan story plays out, because in 1963 he passes away. Now, the end of his life really is a sad story. Ricky Dozan went to a nightclub for a night out, and apparently a Yakuza from a rival organization saw him, and he stabbed Ricky Dozan. There's numerous ways of stories of how the altercation went about, but he was stabbed with a urine soaked blade, which gave him peritonitis, and he was stabbed on December the 8th, and unfortunately on December the 15th he died. And there is all sorts of stories and allegations, which we won't go into, because somebody still might sue us 50 years later. But generally speaking, it was considered to be the problem of the time. And, you know, Murata, who was the person that killed Ricky Dozan, served 7 years for manslaughter, because he didn't directly kill him in the incident, I presume. And reportedly, every year after that, he would call up members of Ricky Dozan's family and apologize, and would always visit Ricky Dozan's grave for what he did. So it's kind of an interesting and eerie story, but it adds to the legacy of Ricky Dozan.
Yeah, that is very eerie. Obviously, a hugely sad loss, and kind of, you know, a man, you know, that important, that achieved success very much early in his career, and was, you know, really, you know, still prominent at the time. Life cut short at the tender age of 39. And then obviously, I think me and you have had our fair share of podcasts talking about deceased wrestlers, unfortunately.
We have, yes, many, many times.
But, you know, like you said, it's eerie in the fact that it very much went along with the overall career of Dozan. And I guess if anything can be taken away from that particular instances that the guy did seem to have some remorse calling up his family and you know, visiting his grave. Obviously, you would want somebody to, you know, think about and have that type of sympathy and reverence beforehand, but
but the legacy of Ricky Dozan is still all powerful, and the legacy of Ricky Dozan in his matches and his appearance as such a dominating force in Japanese wrestling. And to give you an idea of how popular he was, the 1957 match with Lou Thesz for the NWA World Heavyweight Championship drew an 87.0 percentage rating. That meant 87% of television owners in Japan were watching that match. When you consider that Raw struggles to get 3% now.
For 3 hours, yeah.
For a three-hour show. And this was just for one match, bear in mind. There wasn't anything else on the card. This was just for one match. It was 87.0. And then when he wrestled the Destroyer in 1963, he managed a drawing rating of 67.0. But obviously in 1963, more people had television sets, so it was actually a larger viewing audience.
Yeah, and of course, back, I mean, you know, this is a different age, and obviously people, the way, you know, attention spans are now and the way people view and watch their programs are completely different. But again, I think that's just credence to, you know, that time period and the style in which they, you know, that kind of strong style that was very much becoming the foundation at that time. And, you know, the legitimacy, like I said, of the in-ring, how serious the fans took it. Obviously, like we talked about before, they were not in bingo halls by any stretch of the imagination. these guys were very much prominent in, you know, in who they were, and the championships were, you know, taken very seriously. So, you know, it almost feels like it's just a completely different climate to what we get today, despite, you know, that we do have a lot of exciting things today. But back then it was just so, like I said, going back to that match that he had, where you kind of, you know, went off shoot, if you will. It was gritty, it was visceral, and it just, you know, you can't beat that reality feeling that has just stayed through to today that we get from New Japan. So
yeah, it was interesting because me and Gavin were talking about CM Punk and his MMA debut yesterday as we were recording this, and 2 days ago as you're listening to it, and you know, we were talking about like that. The fact that, you know, wrestling doesn't necessarily have badasses anymore. And this is a good reason, you know, Rocky Dozan's an example of though he wasn't a true badass, he certainly could handle himself. He certainly brought that realism from the judo world into pro wrestling because of his genuine sports background and his genuine combat sports background, I think.
Yeah, and it's interesting seeing, and I guess that kind of, you know, like I said, brings us back to today where it kind of feels like it's a completely different, I mean, obviously it's a different era and everything, but just, you know, trying to see those, some of those wrestling traditions kind of trickle down today and kind of maybe fade out at times just because of the way, you know, certain business practices are obviously in the WWE and other places. But like you said, it doesn't feel like, you know, real badasses anymore, you know, except a few here and there. Obviously, you are the first name that comes to mind is a guy like Brock Lesnar, who was considered very much a badass before he went to mixed martial arts, but now even more so to the point where he's allowed a litany of more freedoms than we get from a lot of talents today. But again, like you said, the perception of these guys, even despite how they look and the things that they can do, aren't perceived as badasses to the point where real fighters are, you know, almost trying to make a joke and calling them out, which is interesting because I don't necessarily know if we'll ever really get those particular standoffs with guys coming into the, you know, WWE and whatnot for just, you know, one-offs like we got with, you know, Floyd and Big Show, Floyd Mayweather, obviously, and Big Show. But yeah, I guess it's where it is now. You know, guys really feel like they can come up to these performers or throw things at them at the shows or just, you know, jump the guardrail and get in their face. And obviously, due to the confines for the companies they work for, they don't always get to touch them. But if they could, and kind of teach them a lesson, I think that might almost offer more credence into getting back to that legitimacy that, you know, guys like Ricky Dozan and others have, you know, worked so hard to create over the years.
Yeah, there was an interesting story in Dynamite Kid's biography about kids would bring in packs of cigarettes all the time. And, like, did someone come up to go, like, Dynamite son, I am Lucky Strike boy, here are Lucky Strike cigarettes. And then Dynamite say thank you and slap him in the face, and the guy would bow and go away. And that was that because Dynamite was the Gaijin and he understood his role, and his role was to beat the hell out of people. Him and him and Davey beat up a kid in the audience on the way to the ring one night, and did go to prison for it. But the promoters were exceptionally happy with him because that's what they were supposed to do, you know. But yeah, it was. Interesting, certainly seeing those old matches that I've been watching this week of Ricky Dozan and his performances, and there was a sense of reality about him. And he wrestled very much like a sumo. He's very much about hand strikes and very much about ever go forward kind of style, you know. And this was the basis of what pro wrestling styles we see today in Japan. This is how it got started. And of course, even after Ricky Dozan's death, there was still 10 years left of the Japan Pro Wrestling Alliance to go before we get to New Japan and Old Japan, which we will probably be talking about soon. But I've watched a few other matches from this particular era, and certainly later as you go through the decade, there's certainly some, how can I put it, traits that everything in Japanese wrestling that you see today certainly came from the JWA. Let's start about the Gaijin influence for a start. The NWA was still the powerhouse wrestling organization before the WWE breakaway. Oh, sorry, WWWF as it was at the time. But they were still the powerhouse organization and providing a lot of the Gaijin talent. And if you look at the roster of JWA's Gaijins, it was a who's who. After Luthez, you had the next set of NWA heavyweight champions, Dory Funk Jr. being a very prominent name on that list. And he brought a lot of Texans with him, like his brother Terry and Dick Murdoch. There was a lot of interesting names in that era that were wrestling in Japan because the money was so good. And because the competition was so good as well.
Yeah, you guys like, I think, Dory Funk, Terry Funk, guys like Harley Race, who wrestled a different style. I think King's Road is what they called it.
Yeah, we haven't got to King's Road just yet. But the birth of King's Road kind of starts happening now.
Yeah, obviously, they wrestled a different style, but I think it was that contrast. Kind of piggybacking off that, you know, what Ricky Dozan capitalized off of with that, you know, the Japanese hero versus the American villain, and, you know, kind of seeing those, those matches and that, you know, that contrast, and really brought the excitement for Japanese fans at the time, And like you said, the who's who of guys like Dory Funk, you know, Terry and others who was very much, like I said, villains when they, you know, wrestled in Japan, but at the same time were very much respected as, you know, the sport is overall in Japan more so than I think a lot of other places. So, yeah, I just think that continued the overall perception of, you know, bringing in Gaijins, and elevated it to where it is today, which obviously we almost at a tipping point coming out of G1. So, I just think that just continued to build a bridge that we've gotten to today.
I find it interesting. It's like I watched a match with Dory Funk and Dick Murdoch in, you know, and it's Dick Murdoch, Texas Redneck, Captain Redneck Dick Murdoch, and Dory Funk Jr., who at the time was, we were being told by Gordon Solie, had ice water running through his veins. And they get in the ring and they're very nice and polite and they nod and shake hands with everybody and the referee and then presume to have a scientific wrestling match. And it's like, what? It's like, you're the two of the baddest bad guys in the world and you're going to have a nice, pleasant little wrestling match with these Japanese fellows.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, really interesting to watch. Eventually, they kind of like broke out into heeldom, but it was very, very respectful, kind of much more like a sporting orientated match. I guess this was the time when you were still, Gaijin were still the bad guys because they were Gaijin. You didn't really have the respected Gaijins who could cross over to being faces at that particular point.
Yeah, and I don't know. Maybe that's just a time thing. Maybe that's obviously the level and variety of talent has changed over the years. But maybe I think that's just a time thing, because, like you said, in during that time and coming out of that Dozan era, they were very much looking for a hero at that time, and I think. While there was, you know, kind of respect being slowly built for the Gaijins, it was just more so to their own top talent. So I think that's, I think it's just grown over time when it comes to the Gaijin, which is still very much a story arc and overall storytelling in Japanese wrestling today.
Yeah. So the JWA, like we said, it established these things. One of the other things I noticed that it established is the idea of a stable and the idea of a faction, which is obviously a driving force in New Japan Pro Wrestling with Bullet Club and Chaos and GBH. And a lot of it was down to supporting your fellow wrestlers. It began because of that sports analogy. If you watch the big main events in JWA matches, most of the faces, the Japanese homegrown talent, have the rest of the roster in their corner. There's like seven or eight guys cornering them. And when the first fall ends, they all jump in the ring with water buckets and stools and towels. It's a bit of a sight to see, to be honest. And they're giving advice and doing rubdowns, and, you know, it's all very slick and professional. It gave that sense of realism to it.
Yeah, it's almost like really natural storytelling. Obviously, these guys are not the hometown boys. And even if they don't get along, it's like, you know, no matter, you know, how we see each other, they all think we suck. So, you know, at this point, we might as well, you know, there's strength in numbers, and, you know, we might as well get together. And obviously, like you said, that's exploded today into what we've gotten. And obviously, you know, factions like Bullet Club have blown up huge, become almost had a cult following today because just of instances like that.
Yeah, and a lot of that, it probably came a little bit later with Tenryu in All Japan and War. But that stable outlook and how stables worked in pro wrestling became very important to the Japanese identity of how pro wrestling worked, and the idea of the guys in your corner, whether they were good guys or bad guys. It became a set of philosophy, you know, the great factions in Japanese wrestling, like Burning in All Japan Pro Wrestling in the 90s with Misawa and Kobashi and Akiyama. That was a really intense kind of experience as a faction. You know, they were really important to the identity of the company, and it came from sumo because Doki Dozan was a sumo, and that sense of collective thought process, which is another Japanese trait, is a collectivist society. You know, I was watching some of the film of the Thez matches, and one of the promos of the Thez matches, and it shows them actually digging the foundations for the dojo. for the JWA dojo that they hope to put together. And it was the wrestlers themselves were digging the foundations. And you see a young Giant Bama and a young Antonio Inoki with picks and shovels digging holes to build foundations for the dojo. It was a very collectivist idea of how pro wrestling should work.
Obviously, when those, you know, two people step into a ring, it's very much a dance. You know, you can't, it just isn't a one-sided thing. But overall, I think why, you know, Japan has thrived for so long, especially looking at New Japan today, is because, like you said, that collective thought process, you know, doing this, you know, slowly building to this, making this seem important, holding this person back for right now, elevating them somewhere like in a grand tournament like the G1. It's just, the kind of, you know, thinking towards that main goal, down the line, as opposed to the, you know, immediate successes. They kind of think long term more so. A lot of times that we get over here. So I think, you know, having that collective mind and focusing on it and sticking the course, which I think is something has been done well in Japan, is, like you said, it's just something that's really been a foundation, for a lot of promotions, especially, you know, the JWA.
Yeah. And speaking of foundations of Japanese wrestling, perhaps the biggest influence JWA had that we still feel today, and certainly me, you, and Chelsea, and Alex felt this summer, was the idea of an annual tournament. And that really began in the JWA. So, you know, the G1 Climax and the G1 Climax tournament and the, big tournaments, Noah and All Japan, the Pro Wrestling Carnival tournaments and the Grand Honored Championship tournaments are descendant from the JWA tournament, which was called World Big League. And the World Big League started in 1959 and was won by Ricky Dozan, unsurprisingly, for the first 5 years. but you look at the people he's wrestling, Mr. X, Leona Mellini, Killer Kowalski, Lou Thesz loses in the final 1 year. You know, this is by 1963, JWA was one of the biggest drawing promotions in the world, and they were getting the top talent. After Ricky Dozan passed away, Tonobori wins the championship twice. He defeats Gene Kaninsky and Freddie Blassie. You know, you're getting big names from North America. Kaninsky was a former NWA champion, or was he a future NWA champion at the time? I can't remember. He's somewhere between the titles, I think. But then the next name, the next ace, comes into the picture, which is Giant Baba. And he wins the championship six times between 1966 and 1972. In 66, he defeats Wilbur Snyder. In 67, he defeats The Destroyer, one of Ricky Dozan's main nemeses. Then he beats Don Leo Jonathan in 1970, Abdullah the Butcher in 1971, and Gorilla Monsoon in 1972. You know, anyone who just thinks of Gorilla Monsoon as the friendly, happy face of WWE in the 80s, he was a well-known top heel in all over the world. And, you know, I think one day we should probably do a show on the things Gorilla Monsoon did before he became a family entertainment announcer. but that's different for another time. But you can see the importance of these tournaments are starting to show in wrestling very early in Japan. Again, that realism, that sports element. There was a tag league tournament as well, which the current New Japan Tag League, World Tag League, is named after. And Antonio Inoki turned out to be a bit of a specialist in that, winning the championship twice with Kanetori Hoshino and Seiji Sakaguchi in 1970 and 1971. But looking at the people they wrestled, Big John Quinn and Nick Bockwinkel, Killer Kowalski and Buddy Austin, this is top name wrestlers doing top name stuff.
Yeah, we've talked about it before with, you know, in terms of tournaments that, you know, they're classic, that, you know, easy for fans to follow, very much that mano a mano type big level competition. And with these tournaments specifically, you know, these were guys, much like we get a G1 Climax today, from all over the world, and you're almost guaranteed to see great matches. And, you know, to the consistency, you know, that, you know, Japan has been able to hold even back then, it's just a credence to the overall, you know, how they just, you know, view and treat the sport and present it in general. Because, like you said, even, you know, back then, it was a huge thing. And it's funny talking about Ricky Dozan, and he kind of was the Tanahashi of his tournament at times. But again, he was a guy who could hold that level of you know, credence, and very much it wasn't seen as a bad thing because he very much was the guy at that time. So, you know, but obviously working with talents like, you know, Freddie Blassie, the Destroyer, you know, like you said, Gamilla Wasson, Killer Kowalski, all those names would, you know, go on to make their own notes in history.
Yeah. And that was, you know, there was 10 years of wrestling without Ricky Dozan before things started to fall apart. In 1966, another wrestling organization, International Wrestling Enterprise, was founded in Tokyo, and it started to eat into JWA's draw, partly because International Wrestling Enterprise was doing very different things. They were a bit of a deathmatch promotion. They were a bit of a blood and guts promotion in comparison to JWA. They were doing non-traditional things, and they were all internal because they weren't members of the NWA. Obviously, the NWA only supported one company in each territory, and the JWA was it. So they were doing things that were very homegrown. They weren't bringing in as many Gaijins. They were doing things differently, and that started to affect what JWA was doing. And then in 1973, Giant Baba and Antonio Inoki both left JWA, which was really the death knell for the company. JWA's big draw in the late 1960s was Giant Baba, and Inoki felt he was always under the shadow of Baba, which is probably quite true, and he felt he could strike out on his own. When Inoki left, there was a power vacuum, which Baba filled by taking all the wrestlers to form All Japan Pro Wrestling, really. And there was kind of a sad end to the first promotion that was really, really the core ideal of what Japanese wrestling would become. But it did start two promotions and two entirely different philosophies on how pro wrestling was going to work, which will be the subject of a future episode of this particular series. However, what do you think the legacy of JWA has been in Japan and in the greater wrestling world, Marcus?
You know, just obviously, I think, you know, that foundation that really was set, you know, like you said, by Ricky Dozan, that style, that, you know, that face, you know, kind of the hero, you know, Japanese guy versus the villain Gaijin, which we've seen, you know, obviously throughout all these years. Like you said, with the dojos and things of that nature, and the way things presented, and even more importantly, you know, the tournaments. And I think just the level of talent that's traversed, you know, both Japan and America over the years has just grown. And I think obviously, I think when you look at a broader scope in today's world, it's seen as, you know, now guys are growing up and not necessarily saying that whole thing of when I was a kid, I've always just, you know, wanted to go to WWE and that's it. And cause that's, you know, the mainstream thing. But now, you know, you're hearing wrestlers say, when I grew up, the first thing I wanted to do, you know, that in my mind would be a big success is go to Japan. I wanted to wrestle in Japan. And I think, you know, just hearing things like that from, you know, talents like Sasha Banks and, you know, others. And obviously, you and Alex can get off to the Joshi, thing far more than I could. I just think just the overall, you know, ingratiating the perspective of, you know, Japan pro wrestling and that whole, you know, legit style and, you know, what it could mean for wrestlers coming over and interacting with these homegrown talents, and obviously those talents traversing these waters, and basically just what it can do for the business overall, I think is just continued to grow, and I think it's been something fantastic for the sport, and it shines through the day than none other better than New Japan, which is really one great thing that came out of you know, like you just said, the downfall of JWA because of, you know, Inoki feeling like he was in Baba's shadow, which is quite believable because of how tiring the man was. So yeah, I think overall it really just built the foundation for what we have today, and it's been, you know, really great to talk about, you know, Ricky Dozan and again the foundation that he set, because, you know, someone had to do it, and I think you know, the bravery, the consistent mindset that he kept, not only as a professional wrestler but as a businessman, like you said, which can't be slighted at all, because it takes, you know, especially in today's society, you can't be no dummy in today's climate, because there are just so many different facets that you have to have as a performer overall. So yeah, I just think it's really, you know, like I said, in terms of the tournaments, in terms of the legitimacy of the sport that's carried through the day, and the fans just respecting it overall is what its legacy.
When you look at the JWA, there is so much that set up what was going on in Japanese wrestling for the next, well, 60 years, and is still going on today. But the key things that we can take from today's episode are the idea of a company ace, the idea of annual tournaments to establish the flow of your stories for the year, the use of Gaijin as the always reliable bad guy, the use of factions to set apart certain wrestlers and to build alliances and to give an idea of story impetus, and also the idea of sporting presentation to make wrestling believable. I think those are the key factors that have kept JWA relevant to all wrestling promoters in Japan ever since. And the next episode in this series, when we look at men's wrestling, will obviously concentrate on the birth of New Japan Pro Wrestling and All Japan Pro Wrestling, and that ongoing tension between Shohei Giant Baba and Antonio Inoki. But the next episode, I think we should really look at women's wrestling in Japan, because that's such a big part of the story of Japanese wrestling. So we're going to look at the birth of Japanese wrestling for women in Japan, and we're going to look at the birth of the All Japan Pro. We're going to look at the birth of All Japan Women and the Matsunaga brothers and their influence on pro wrestling. So thank you for your time today. Thank you, Marcus.
No, thank you for having me. It was great talking to you, and once again, as always, talking to you, getting a grand lesson on this stuff. So
yeah, it's been fun. I like doing these ones where we can inform people and hope you find something cool in what we're saying, and go look up some matches. And those matches aren't necessarily technically wondrous, but they are historically important, and you can see a direct line from Riki Dozan to Shinsuke Nakamura. You know, you can see how it all fits together. So I think it's really important that you go look at those matches. Marcus is at Paradox Kid on Twitter. I am at Sheriff Lone Star. You can contact us there if you want to talk more stuff about wrestling. We're quite willing to chat. And you can listen to the rest of the podcasts on the WrestleTalk Podcast Network. The Squash will be out tomorrow with me and Gavin. We'll be talking about CM Punk and his MMA performances and MMA in wrestling generally. We also have the Finn Martin Report next Sunday. Also, you can find us on WrestlePlus at $4.99 a month, along with all the other content that we do, plus exclusive new content from Ollie Davis and the YouTube team, from the NGW Pro Wrestling that we have there, the entire WrestleTalk archive. So much cool stuff for $4.99 a month. Well worth your investment. We will see you soon. Thank you very much for listening. Take care, and bye.